Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am swell.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, has Blake Lively been slandered or attacked or unfairly attacked or I don't know how we want to describe this exactly, by a PR hatchet team? That's at least the supposition made in a big New York Times article story that came out this week about the fight behind the scenes between Blake Lively and director slash co-star Justin Baldoni on the set of It Ends With Us. Now, we didn't talk about It Ends With Us on the show, but it was a big hit this fall, as folks flocked to see it. It also was the subject of some matter of controversy when it came out, because there were all these stories in the press about Blake Lively being terrible, and oh, she was so controlling on the set, and oh, look at these old interviews with Blake Lively. She's so mean and so awful to people. Don't we all want to really just really get down on Blake Lively? Turns out that Wayfarer Studio, Justin Baldoni and Jamie Heath, hired a crisis management firm, an expert, Melissa Nathan, her team, which included hired gun Jed Wallace, to savage Lively in the press, according to a legal complaint filed by Blake Lively and her team that the New York Times got a hold of. Amongst the items in this complaint is the revelation that I want to separate two different things here. There's what's in the story, there's what's in the New York Times story, and there's what's in the complaint filed by Blake Lively and her team, which are slightly different things. I think the New York Times story is a little bit more measured and just gets into very specific things that can be tracked to text messages that have been subpoenaed by Blake Lively and her team. But one of the things, amongst the items in the complaint that Lively filed, hold on, let me just pull it up here real quick, because I want to make sure I get this right. It's important to be accurate. So amongst the things that Lively and her team met with the Wayfarer Studios PR and HR reps to ensure did not happen on the set going forward: no more entering, attempting to enter, interrupting, pressuring, or asking Blake Lively to enter her trailer or the makeup trailer by Mr. Heath or Mr. Baldoni while she is nude for any reason. That's one of the things she asked for. Here's another thing she asked for: no more private, multi-hour meetings in Blake Lively's trailer with Mr. Baldoni crying, with no outside Blake Lively appointed representative to monitor, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the complaint has lots of things like that. The New York Times story is more focused fairly tightly on the PR strategy that accompanied the rollout of this film. And again, I didn't review the movie. I haven't even actually watched the movie. But when the movie was coming out, there was a weirdly concerted PR campaign around it to kind of undermine it, seemingly from within the campaign of the film itself. Am I wrong on this, guys? Do you remember this? Was it weird to you guys?
It was odd. It is rare to see, stands kind of taking sides of various co-stars in a movie, to the extent that this happened. It seemed a little weird at the time, I think is probably right.
I did not notice one single thing because I didn't see the movie, didn't want to see the movie, and don't read gossip press.
Yeah, again, the whole thing was very weird. It was very weird. Part of the positioning of this movie was that director and star James Baldoni, or Justin Baldoni, and Jamie Heath, who was the producer, they had, according to the New York Times, quote, positioned themselves as feminist allies in the Me Too era, end quote. And I don't know how many times we have to see this story play out before we realize that is an enormous red flag. You know, the issue with this film, or at least the marketing around this film, was there was a lot of discussion about whether or not there was a creative power struggle behind the scenes, right? There was a lot of talk about, well, Blake Lively had one cut of the film and Baldoni had another cut of the film and the studio went with Blake Lively's cut of the film and he was angry about this and blah, blah, blah. And I remember following all this and thinking, oh, that's kind of interesting. That's kind of interesting. But I also do remember, again, there was this incredibly viral video of Norwegian interviewer Kirsti Flå, who went viral for this weird, again, very, very weird interview where she basically accused Blake Lively of wanting her to get out of the game of interviewing altogether. She was like, I don't want to do this anymore because I asked Blake Lively a question about my baby bump and she reacted very poorly. And this was then paired with several other interviews she had done with Amber Heard and Anne Hathaway, where those starlets also looked bad. And, you know, and I got to say, even at the time, I was like, maybe she's just bad at asking interview questions. Maybe this is just a bad interviewer. But it turns out there may have been something more nefarious involved. This PR firm was involved with Johnny Depp's legal team. Anyway, there's all sorts of interesting...
The interviewer does flatly deny that.
She does flatly deny it. She flatly denies it. And this is the other real broad issue here, right? Which is how much of this was orchestrated by a PR team? How much of it is just journalists seeking to go viral, TikTok interviewers looking to go viral? How much of it is just the nature of the modern internet with its voracious appetite for finding a new thing, latching onto it, and destroying that thing in the briefest amount of time possible? Alyssa, what did you make of this story? Because there are so many different facets and aspects of it that I'm fascinated to see what you thought of it.
Yeah, I mean, I sent it to both of you, and I want to stress that I feel like I don't have a super strong sense of what happened on the set of this movie. I obviously haven't done any independent reporting. And, you know, I have no opinion on whether sort of the, you know, the paperwork filed by Blake Lively's legal team represents sort of a serious attempt to assert a legal case or to, you know, look for sort of state intervention here, or whether that's sort of PR. But I was most struck by the sort of glimpse inside the working of one of these PR firms. Because like you, Sunny, I do sort of remember that there seemed to be kind of an odd miasma around the film. And, you know, I sort of attributed it at the time to, oh, you know, Colleen Hoover's big on book talk. You know, there are people, it's, you know, a movie about which people are just going to have strong feelings about the adaptation, and kind of chalked it up to that. But getting a very sort of unvarnished glimpse into the workings of one of these PR firms is just a good reminder of how hard it is to tell if any of these internet kerfuffles are organic or manufactured, right? I mean, it seems pretty clear that these folks were hired to destroy Blake Lively's reputation and, like, did a pretty good job of it. And it's just, you know, the discussion of, like, oh, it's not going to be bots. You know, we don't do that. That's too easily traced. But, you know, we will go in and, you know, just really trash someone's reputation for hire. It's a good reminder that it's hard to tell what's real on the internet. On the internet, no one knows if you're a dog or a, you know, sort of...
an extremely highly paid Hollywood consultant.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean...
Maybe you're both.
Peter, this is, like, again, looking at this from the perspective of an editor who edits, you know, stories, right? Like, judging source quality is always an issue in stories like this, right? And I think there's a secondary question here, which is how much... I saw a bunch of people saying on social media, oh, well, the news media really has to look at itself and try and figure out, you know, what they did wrong here. And I'm skeptical that this is really an issue of the news media proper, like actual journalistic outlets, versus just the simple nature of the internet and how things go viral and the frankly, the lack of gatekeepers.
So I didn't take notes, and it's possible that I'm going to be slightly in error here. But if I recall correctly, the only two examples of actual journalists in who are real, like something close to journalistic professionals, who are named or mentioned in the piece is the piece mentions the Daily Mail, doesn't actually name a journalist, but mentions an outlet, the Daily Mail, and an editor at the Daily Mail who is ready to go. And then there was a story that featured that's mentioned a couple of times that's something like, is Blake Lively about to get canceled? I may be slightly botching the headline. Don't have it in front of me. All right. So there's the Daily Mail, and then there's that Norwegian, is that right? Norwegian yep. interviewer who... Yep. Interviewed Blake Lively, resurfaced, or at least the clip was resurfaced of her interviewing Blake Lively, and also appears to have interviewed other people who may have been targets of this firm. That the story doesn't actually come out and say that that's true. It implies that it could be true, and then she flatly denies it. So it's a little complicated, but this is not to me mostly a story about traditional media or journalists or even like kind of internet journalists, with the sort of exception of the Daily Mail, which we all understand is a specific kind of gossipy, celebrity focused publication in the way that it treats this sort of material. And it is instead a story about social media and the weirdness of social media and the way that it is manipulated. But also the thing is reading the story is that both of you have pointed out is if you're reading closely, it's not clear how much these highly paid consultants are actually directly themselves doing the manipulation. And what because part of like there's a line in the story that talks about one of the firms that's the guy who runs a firm. It's like we can't really find out much about this guy. His digital paper trail or something like that is very like mysterious. Like there's not much there. And we don't really know what he's doing. Like the Times again, I'm summarizing, but the Times yeah. includes a line that's like, well, there's a guy and we don't know much about him and we don't know what he does. But maybe yeah, I mean, he's doing something.
And it's entirely possible. It seems
likely that he's getting paid a lot to do something.
Well, and it's also entirely possible that the weird sort of school of fish nature of social media means that these firms can, you know, maybe get paid to do not a lot, right? I mean, if you're like, I will do something untraceable that doesn't involve bots to manipulate social media.
So this is the question I want to ask, I think, both of you is, I think there's a real chance, and I want to stress, this is totally speculative, and this is a chance, this my speculation here might be totally wrong, but there's a real chance that the backlash against Blake Lively that surrounded this film was not mostly bought and paid for. That someone tried to buy it, but the thing that actually happened under the surface was that people, like posters on Reddit actually didn't like Blake Lively. And again, I don't want to say that that's definitely what happened or even probably what happened. But if you read the story, it leaves that open as a possibility. And again, it also just seems crazy to me that there's so much money and professional expertise and like Blake Lively is hiring, her own people to do forensics on like her social media. Right. In addition to the other guy hiring some people to have some sort of response to her, whatever we're going to call it. People who say who text things like, of course, we can bury anyone. But we're not going to say on text that we are, in fact, trying to bury her.
Yeah.
Right. Like this. And there's and then the craziest texts to me were like, we're the ones about Reddit where they were like, oh, man, the narrative on Reddit is crazy. It's going totally in our favor. It's going like they're surprised by how hard the narrative on Reddit has swung yeah. in their favor because it in a way that suggests that they don't even know what they're doing that is effective. They know that I'm sure they're doing something. I'm sure they're not doing literally nothing. But is the thing that they're doing what's causing this, or is it? Is it something else? It's also vague and also murky. The only thing that's like pretty flatly that you could rule out is I'm pretty sure they're actually not using bots. But like, beyond that, what are they doing here?
Yeah.
And if they're not using bots, then what does that tell you is that these are, even if in maybe in some cases, like paid accounts, you know, people, you know, there might be a guy who's just sort of running a bunch of social media accounts. He's got a ton of Reddit, you know, logins that he like something like that. I can totally imagine a scenario like that. But also, this might be much more organic than it seems like, given the fact, like, how do I say this? Imagine, Sonny, that you paid me to make you popular on the internet. And I was like, yes, you give me a lot of money and I'm going to do that. And then I sent an email. And then the next year you turned out to be a really popular on the internet. Would that have been my fault because you paid me a lot of money to do that? Like, that might be what
first
we're talking
all,
about here. But also,
first of all,
it's so insane.
I am already very popular on the internet.
Right,
I don't need you
and
sending
maybe,
emails.
And again, maybe this is the thing, is I don't have a deep sense of, like, was yeah. there a noticeable, trackable, measurable shift in Blake Lively's popularity or the social media narrative about her? That does seem like there was some sort of, I don't know, there was a more intense discussion. But as you noted, this was a movie based on a Colleen Hoover book. And Colleen Hoover, for those who don't know, is probably the most successful fiction author of the last five-ish years, maybe 10 even.
10,
right.
Yeah.
To the point where if you check the New York Times fiction bestseller list, I think maybe not this week or the last couple of weeks, but for periods of time, she will have multiple books, four even, like on the top 10 list, right? It's just like, she's the only fiction that's being read in America. This is an exaggeration, but has kind of seemed like that just reading the bestseller lists. And there are people who are very, very intense about her work and anything that's associated with that. And that way predated any paid media campaign against Blake Lively.
Yeah. I will also say that, you know, this is also sort of the equivalent of, like, you know, Peter, say, you hired me to make Sonny very popular on the internet. And, like, you and I was emailing with, like, my team of, like, you know, cheerful associates, because this is a totally inverse scenario. And we were also sending around a lot of emails. It's like, we should make sure that, like, this plan doesn't get out in the world, because it would be like, you know, we're in DC is doing.
Also so crazy. You don't right. text somebody that you can't say the thing that you're doing in it, but you're saying that you can't, that there's a thing out there that you're not going to admit. It's just.
Yeah. I mean, and the fact that everyone in this movie seemed to be unable to resolve this stuff like adults by sort of talking to each other, or even like hiring a professional mediator to just sort of set an agreement for how all of this was going to work. And instead, like, just like hiring people to make other people look bad on the internet. Like, I'm sorry, what is this? Like the competition to get onto like a Texas cheerleading squad or something? Like, it's just insane.
Can we, I just want to backtrack, because what's really fascinating here is how did all of this start? How did all of this start was when the director and star, Justin Baldoni, found out that Ryan Reynolds, Blake Lively's husband, had blocked him on Instagram. Sure. He found out, he was like, oh shit, Ryan Reynolds has blocked me on Instagram. I need to go on the offensive to take down Blake Lively. Otherwise, I'm screwed. And that's literally the impetus of this whole thing. It's fascinating. It is fascinating. And look, again, I don't think we should underestimate the extent to which this Blake Lively legal action is itself a piece of PR, right? Because what is the real upshot of this story, right? There's a New York Times story that links to this her legal complaint, which has all of these like really damning accusations against the studio and the director and the star, basically everyone who is not Blake Lively, who is involved with this movie. Like, it has really damaging stuff that is not proven. These are all accusations. It's a complaint, et cetera, et cetera. And like, I find all of this fascinating on so many different levels, just because there are, like, this is the collision of all of our worlds. It's the collision of movies and the press and how the press covers movies, and also like how the press covers itself,
yeah.
frankly, because I don't think I'm not saying there is good reason to be skeptical about this story. I take the story in the New York Times at face value. But at the same time, like, what's the story behind the story here? What is the purpose of this story? It's not like it just organically came into the world.
Having that legal document out there, whatever the status of it is, can someone describe the specific status of that legal document? Because it's not a lawsuit, right?
It's not a lawsuit. It's a legal complaint. It has to do with the California Civil Rights Commission, I believe, which is its own thing. The thing I'm most curious about is how they got all the text messages from this firm, which seem to have been acquired via subpoena. Somebody has subpoena power somewhere. I don't know.
Yeah. So the story just said through discovery.
Right.
And it wasn't clear on that. But having that document out there allows a respectable outlet to write a story like this based on what is in the document. And this is, so you asked about sort of the editor sourcing aspect of this. It is not uncommon. I won't say it's true the majority of the time, but it is not uncommon for a complex story to be in the works. And the reporter has good reason to believe a bunch of stuff that the reporter wants to put into a story. But the reporter just doesn't quite have enough to prove, right, that it's there and, or to print it. And so the reporter waits until there is something that is filed by a lawyer in something like a court or a legal process that is in the public domain. And it's like, then the existence of that thing, first of all, allows you to say this has been alleged, right? That this is out there. That protects you as a journalist, because it is simply factually true that these allegations have been made in this forum. And that's what you are reporting, rather than these allegations, something, right? Like, you are reporting that the allegations exist.
Yeah. And it is also legitimately a way to sort of get access to documents. And lawyers can be strategic about that. I mean, if you guys remember Spotlight, there's sort of a pivotal moment when the lawyer played by Stanley Tucci explains that he has put a bunch of information in a filing, almost specifically so the press can track it down and get it.
Yeah. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Blake Lively was savaged by her director and co-star in the press in an effort to undermine her credibility to the rest of the world? Peter!
This whole story is insane, and it's absolutely a controversy if the allegations that Blake Lively is making against the director and her co-star are even partially true.
Alyssa?
It's super controversial.
This is hilariously controversial. I mean, like, it is, again, it was a very weird thing to experience in real time as somebody who did not see the movie and wasn't really that interested in seeing the movie. It seemed to be like the movie was at war with itself. And it turns out it was. Turns out it was. Super controversial. All right. No bonus episode this week. Christmas is here. We're taking the Friday off. So spend the time with your families instead of listening to us. It's better for your soul, probably. All right. And now on to the main event. Amelia Perez, one of the most fascinatingly misconceived movies I think we've ever done on this show, that has nevertheless earned 10 Golden Globe nominations and is Netflix's standard bearer headed into the award season. This is the movie they think is going to rack them up all the Oscar nominations this year, folks. I'm curious to see how that works out for them. Here's what you need to know about Amelia Perez. It is really more of an opera than a traditional movie musical or like kind of stage musical brought to the movies. This is an opera. This is operatic, right? Zoe Saldana stars as Rita Mora Castro. She is a lawyer who is tired of defending the scumbags of the earth for not very much money. She is approached by Juan Manitas Del Monte, who is played in both this role and later.
She's kidnapped by.
approached first and then kidnapped, you know, it's hard to say. Juan Manitas Del Monte, who is played first in this role and then later as Amelia Perez by Carla Sofia Gasson. She is a drug lord who wants to have a sex change operation, and she wants to have Zoe Saldana organize all of this, which involves her going around the country, including to, I believe it's a Bangkok
clinic. The Bangkok scene is the single worst scene I have seen on screen this year, and I saw Madame Web.
Oh no, it's fascinating, Peter. It's fascinating. We'll come back to that. But anyway, long story short, Rita arranges this. Juan becomes Amelia. She goes off and becomes not a drug lord. She sends her wife and their children, who is played, the wife is played by Selena Gomez, off to Switzerland, and realizes that she can't live without Selena Gomez and her children, and so she brings them back to Mexico to live with Amelia Perez as her. Look, I'm sorry, even explaining the plot of this movie makes me like very nervous. I feel like I'm going to get canceled just stumbling
like Blake Lively.
I feel like I'm really going to get canceled just stumbling over the language of how to describe what happens in this movie. But the long and the short of it is, it's a movie in which a drug dealer undergoes a sex change operation to become a respectable member of society and can't quite get over the hump, and everything ends in tragedy. All right, so I'm happy to have you guys correct anything that I've said about this in a moment. Let's just run through the big points here. Is this problematic? Is this movie problematic? Now, here's, again, this is why I'm fascinated by Netflix's choice here, because it is, that Bangkok scene, that Bangkok scene where they're literally dancing around a sex change clinic, and they're using the term sex change, which I know is in and of itself problematic. I know we're supposed to say gender affirming.
Gender
surgery,
confirmation.
Gender affirmation, whatever. But like the whole point is that's what they say in the scene. I'm just saying that because that's what they say in the scene. And there's been lots of outrage about this. It's been very, very controversial. Let's set all that aside. Is the movie in and of itself just totally misconceived? I say yes. Look, here's the thing. It's actually like there's an interesting version of this movie that is about three people who are driven by their own greed and their own impulses and their own lack of impulse control, right? And that version of the movie kind of really wrestles with the desire for gratification and the desire for acknowledgement, the desire for financial success that overcomes all other moral impulses. And I don't think the movie really does that. I don't think it actually really wrestles with that. I think it kind of tries to let more or less everybody off the hook. Certainly it lets off Amelia Perez and Rita Mora Castro off the hook in this regard. I really feel like they are kind of given a pass on a lot of what happens in this movie. Like spoilers here, I guess, if you're worried about spoilers, if you haven't watched the movie, I don't know why you're listening still, because I've discussed so much of it. In the first half of the movie, we are introduced to this drug kingpin in Mexico who, I don't know if you know anything about the cartels, folks. They're bad folks. A lot of murders, a lot of tortures, dismemberments.
There's this weird underlying assumption that, like, Amelia was, like, a drug lord and that's not so great. But, like, She wasn't like the other drug lords who were like murdering everybody.
I don't even think that's true. I think it's just like, yes, she's responsible for all these killings. And then the second half of the movie is her being like, I'm going to help reunite loved ones with the bodies of their loved ones. And that will let me off the hook and it will give them closure. And that's a good thing for me. And I think the movie is actually like, yeah, no, that's actually good. That's like a positive thing. And we should give her kudos for that. I don't think that's true. I think that's false, actually. I think that we should be much more judgmental of everybody involved with all of this. I think more judgmentalism when it comes to this movie would be better than less. I don't know. Look, I will say, in defense of this film, I was never bored. I was never bored by it. It is an interesting movie throughout. Saldana's performance is amazingly energetic. She does, you know, like, she, the dancing she brings to this movie puts everything in Wicked to shame. Like, she is much more physically dynamic than anything in that movie. Her dance sequences are great. Her performance, I think, is very impressive. It's insane. It's an insane movie. I like insane movies. I like movies that are insane. This movie's insane, but I don't like this movie, frankly. I don't know. Peter, what did you make of him? You just got out of Emilia Perez. You turned your TV off and turned on the computer and got right on with us. What did you make of Emilia Perez?
Insane is exactly the right word. And the comparison to Wicked is correct because as complicated as my feelings are about Emilia Perez, I enjoyed it much more than I enjoyed Wicked. And just on a craft level, I mean, with apologies to Wint, you do gotta hand it to them. This is a gorgeous movie in nearly every shot. It is just a pleasure to look at. It is Saldana's performance is energetic and interesting, and a lot of the choreography is also really fascinating. Not all of it works, I think, but there's a bunch of the dance sequences, the way they're integrating the character's state of mind, the environment, and the background characters together here, just is really kind of remarkable. Just again, on a craft level, like to pull this off, to conceive of this, to make it, I don't want to say make it work, but like to make it work on it, you know, in a narrow kind of a discrete sense, scene by scene, moment to moment. There's stuff here that's just like, you kind of have to say, wow. And then you look at the whole thing and you have to say, what the hell? What is that? Like what? I'm still trying to think of. I don't even know. I don't think that this is a truly great movie, but it's not a terrible one either. It's the craziest damn thing I've seen in a long time. In a way that I kind of appreciate, while not thinking that it all comes together. I think that the scene in Bangkok, in particular, is awful. Just like on its own terms and inside the movie, and it's actually too on the nose and goofy. The switch to English just makes, like, drives home the weirdness of it all. It stands out. It's not so ugly. It's the only truly ugly scene in the movie. This super white blue light everywhere just doesn't work at all. But so much of the rest of this movie actually kind of, I was not expecting to like this, and I was really drawn in by, I literally, when we did our Wicked episode, one of my complaints was, I just hated the black levels. The contrast was all wrong in that movie. It's too bright and flat and kind of unpleasant to look at. And man, I loved the black levels in this movie. I loved the photography in this film and just the use of shadow everywhere. Do I think this movie works as a coherence and whole piece of art? I think probably not. And one reason why is that it is a little bit what you were saying, Sonny, that it's not judgmental, but the characters, it's not just that it wants to let them off the hook. It's that the characters are kind of fundamentally shallow characters. There's just not very much to any of them. And in part because the movie doesn't want to judge them, but in part because the movie keeps wanting to move through its sort of artistic it's crazy artistic ambitions in all of these different episodic bits, right? This movie is really feel, it's not actually literally divided into chapters, but it very much feels like a chapterized story. And it's just so determined to get to the next thing rather than to let us see who these people are beyond like the one or two things that we know about them just from the sort of the basics of the setup, that it just doesn't give us, it just doesn't give us enough to hang on to there. So I fundamentally the big conflict in this is about Emilia Perez and her kids. And we get one scene of Emilia Perez as the drug lord with her kids barely interacting with them that like sets that up. Just one, and it's not even a, you see the drug lord like lying on the ground next to the kids, right? It appearing to be happy, and that's it. And then the whole third act is about, oh, I want my kids, and this, right? And like there's shootouts and violent destruction and death, and it's crazy. And it's like, really, that's all you're gonna give us? What is that? What is that even trying to say? What is that story trying? I just feel like it doesn't. It's not. This story is, this movie is incredibly ambitious as a piece of cinematic art, but there's not much of a story and not much in the way of characters. And I think ultimately the conflict that it presents in the end of the film is to the extent that it's makes sense at all, it's actually kind of at war with its idea of becoming of like the goodness of it.
Yeah. I want to. I'm sorry. You said that the Bangkok scene was shot ugly, uglily.
Light. I mean, literally the set design and the light. No. I don't mean what is going on.
I tend to agree with you in terms of how it's supposed to look and how it's supposed to appear to us. But I also think that's intentional, right? Like they are the film is portraying this place as a commercial disaster, right? As like this is the commercialized version of this where they don't actually care about the person behind the procedure. They're just like, you want to become one gender instead of the other gender? Well, here it's $5,000 for this procedure. It's $7,000 for this procedure. Like the whole point of it is to make it kind of sterile and ugly, which is in comparison contrast to the doctor later on who we see from Israel, who is more sympathetic and more empathetic, right? Is like, anyway,
yeah, it's a much more organic setting just in the doctor's office that sort of almost looks like a real doctor's office.
I think you can defend movie. I think you can defend this movie aesthetically much more simply than you can thematically or in terms of story, right, Alyssa? Here, I'm sorry, before you start, can I read the three text messages you sent to us?
Sure.
Before, just to the audience, so we can get this is what Alyssa watched it before either Peter or I did. Here's what she said on Friday. Friday, she said to us, "This movie is utterly insane." That's first text message. Second one, "It might actually be unwatchable." Third, "Just unbelievably terrible." That was your response. That was your immediate response to this film.
Yeah, I really, really hated this movie. And I think that I think there are sort of two major problems with it. The first is that the music isn't any good. Like, these songs are not either strong opera songs or like strong musical theater songs. They're just like, they're very repetitive, like, and I speak some Spanish, and so, you know, I was sort of looking out for, like, any kind of wordplay in, the Spanish language lyrics in addition to the subtitles. Like, they're very sort of repetitive and limited, and the songs themselves don't really, like, have arcs. A lot of them are just literally, like, kind of lists of, like, lists. It's very, very sort of, it's very musically inert, which is weird because if you want to make a musical, it seems like you would want to have good music in it. It's just a thought, you know.
Just a thought.
But then I think the second and probably, you know, I don't want to say it's a bigger problem because, like, if you're going to make a musical, there should be a reason, you know, the song should be saying things that are sort of not expressible in sort of organic, like in prose speech, right? And the music provides a sense of heightened emotion, but there is just not enough interest in like sort of what you would say through song that can't be expressed through conversation or even through exposition. And the movie just, to me, has no sense of that at all. I mean, there is literally no reason for it to be a musical other than people are like, this would be, like, let's make a musical. Let's put on a show. Like, let's be the producers.
So did it seem to you that, that the musical aspect of it, I'm not sure it totally worked, but it was a way of distancing, making the whole thing a little bit more of a fantasia and creating a kind of a distance between what the movie is describing and sort of gritty reality.
Oh, I mean, that's obviously an intention. I don't think it works or feels meaningful at all. And then I think the second problem is the sort of question of taste and the calibration of this movie, which I think would have worked better if it was trashier or if it was just like much more sober minded. But I think it is a weird fusion of the two. You know, and it's, I mean, the movie gives you no real sense of Mexico at all, you know, the sort of geographic difference, you know, the different geographic regions, the sort of relationship between the cartels, also just the fact that there's no attempt to retaliate against Emilio Perez is just like so completely insane. And, but, you know, a more sober-minded version of this is like, what is it like to grow up knowing you're trans in a cartel environment, right? Like, what on earth would that be like? And, you know, why would you feel like, what must it be like to feel like you have to fake your death and disappear? You know, what does that do to your own sort of presentation of your masculinity or feeling about your femininity? And the movie literally has no interest in that whatsoever. And again, sort of has no interest in the like sort of cartel milieu at all. And then it could be like, you know, it could ask, like, what is it like to come back? Like, what is Jesse's reaction when she finds out that, like, this woman who, you know, she's just like gone off to live in her house is actually her husband, etc. There's just no sort of realism or attention to that. And it makes the movie's use of the Israeli surgeon who, like, really tries to make sure that, like, this is what Emilio wants and is sort of asking about her life. It makes that character feel sort of inimical to what the movie is doing because the movie has no curiosity about those questions. So why does it make the character, you know, try to answer them on any level? And then I think the other way you could have done this would for it to have been much less tasteful. You know, and I'm not saying like, you know, I think Carlos Sofia Gascon is, you know, a serious, you know, very like dignified actress. I think she's quite strong in this. And I'm not saying that like this should have been like a John Waters production. Like this is not a movie where like you cast Divine in the lead role. The other way to do it would have been to sort of lean into the music more and make it more fantastical and sort of more vulgar to have more, you know, just more of everything, I think. And it's situated in a really odd in-between space between those two options.
Well, let me ask, you know, we people talk a lot about camp, the idea of camp, right? And I have a long held and argued belief that you can't do camp intentionally. You can't like intentionally do camp. It's a thing that only comes about accidentally and organically when you attempt to do a thing in a heartfelt way and fail.
Yeah.
And I think this movie is actually camp in that regard. I think Emilio Perez is trying to do a thing, and I think it's represented in that Israeli surgeon, right? I think the movie has I think the writer of the movie and the director of the movie and the movie itself has its heart in the right place and has so totally miscalibrated what is actually on the screen that this rises to the level of genuine pure camp.
Maybe. I mean, in the sense that it, you know, arises out of this like sort of genuineness. And it does, you know, there is sort of an elegance to this. It's there's obviously, you know, a certain amount of artifice. But I'm actually talking about not necessarily camp, but like trash or kitsch. I think, you know, this movie just kind of lacks a fundamental edge. It's very soft, right? It's like, and, you know, maybe that's coming around to sort of what you were saying, Sunny, about sort of appetite and desire. You know, like, I would be interested to know more about Rita. Like, what the hell does she do with the money? Obviously, she sort of transplants herself to London. But, like, you know, what are her ambitions? You know, who is she more than, you know, someone who's bored? And it's like, okay, I'd like to be rich. And, like, all right, I'll go along with – there's just – there's a lack of sort of edge and desire. It's a very – it's a very just sort of soft kind of – weak-centered movie, and, you know, a version of it that was more fantastical, more, you know, just had more oomph and desire to it. You know, I mean, and I think there's like there's some promise of that, right? When Amelia begins this affair with, you know, Epifania, a woman who's like who was abused by her husband and is like actually kind of delighted to find out that he's dead. I mean, like, you could have done something, again, sort of really interesting and sort of either, you know, harder edged or trashier, where, like, the cartels didn't kill Epifania's husband. She did, right? You could – there's just, you know, there's a – this movie just feels very sort of hermetically sealed. It's very – both very serious about the things that it's serious about, but without any real connection to them. It just has a very airy feel. It's just, I really disliked it. I really disliked it.
You definitely did not like it. I think that is that was clear. I don't know. I don't think this works really. Certainly on the level it's trying to work on. But I also I just didn't hate it. I did not hate it, even though I was kind of expecting to. Peter.
Yeah. Yeah, if a cartel boss
not hating.
If a cartel boss sent a sicario to my house and was like, "You have to watch one 2024 musical again," I think I'd have to pick this one.
Oh, easily. There's nothing else that would come close. I don't. There aren't that many more options. I mean,
it's basically this or Wicked.
This and Wicked and Moana. I don't know. Moana.
I didn't
2,
even see like Moana 2. So
it's terrible.
And so I couldn't watch it again. Would not be possible.
I prefer this to both Moana 2 and Wicked, even though I don't necessarily like it. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Amelia Perez? Peter?
I have never been less prepared to answer that question. I have no idea.
And you're always terrible at answering this question. You're the least decisive member of
this
podcast.
This is the least I've ever known my own reaction to a movie.
Squish. Peter the Squish. Alyssa?
Oh my God, there's so many better things coming out. Like, movies are about to get busy. Don't go to this. Don't subject yourself to this. Why?
You can watch it at home on Netflix.
Still, not worth it.
Mm. So that's a thumbs down from Alyssa, I take it.
Two thumbs down.
Two thumbs. Don't say that. I think we get sued if you say that.
Okay, sorry. One thumb down with lots of apologies to Siskel and Ebert, whom we revere.
Also thumbs down from me. Although, again, I didn't hate it. It's kind of interesting. I found myself intrigued by the things I was seeing on the screen. I hope it didn't awaken anything in me. All right. That's
what?
It for today's. Sorry, that's a reference to Community, folks. Come on. Come on. Who didn't watch Community? Come on. All right. That
I
is it.
I didn't watch Community.
Yeah, I know. You don't like good things. All right, that is it for today's show.
Accurate.
Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode, except not this week because, you know, we're off because of Christmas. It's Christmas! Come on! Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday!